Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey guys, welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. I'm Josh Horowitz, and welcome to my podcast. This week's episode is one of the finest actors working today, without a doubt. So pleased that this one worked out. Michael Fassbender is the guest on Happy, Sad, Confused this week. Michael is in such a zone as an actor, and you just feel like everything is clicking for him. He's in the new movie, Frank, which is an odd kind of black comedy in which Michael plays the entire film, virtually the entire film, in a giant paper mache mask head. He's part of a rock group with Maggie Gyllenhaal and Donald Gleason in the film, and it's a really cool, interesting piece of work that you guys should definitely check out. It's another awesome performance from Fassbender, who obviously has killed it in things like 12 Years a Slave and Shame, not to mention the X-Men films. So I'm really not going to say much more except that it was such a pleasure to catch up with him. He's a smart guy, he's a guy with a wry, fun sense of humor, and he's always cool to catch up with. He was in New York doing a bit of press, including a performance on the Colbert Report, which you guys should definitely check out. No singing in this one, but just good conversation. As always, hit me up on Twitter, guys. Let me know what you think, at Joshua Horowitz with the hashtag #HappySadConfused. And no more preamble. Let's just dive right in. A really cool, fun conversation with the man of the hour. This is his time, Michael Fassbender.
In the spirit of the film, I feel like for the podcast audience, we should explain our facial expressions as we go. Welcoming smile.
Welcoming smile. Tired, satisfied, after breakfast look.
Nap needed look.
Power nap on the way. Power nap 20 minutes away look.
30, I'm sorry, they didn't tell you.
30.
It's a different kind of press tour this time around. I mean, I love the Colbert performance. It was amazing. You also don't get your last time I saw you, you were with your buddy McAvoy, and I feel like, man, from my perspective and anybody's perspective talking to you guys, it was like, I felt like it was the McAvoy Fassbender show, and you were just along for the ride when you guys were together. Oh, it's an interesting dynamic.
That's cool. It's lucky, you know, that James and I just sort of, you know, hit it off really, and got so much respect for him, and care for him as a person outside of the profession, but just working with him as well, it's just so easy, you know. Yeah. And it was very lucky because, you know, part of the X-Men franchise together, it would be awkward if we didn't get along.
You're masking it well, if you are.
Yeah, exactly. So no, he's great. Hopefully going to catch up with him soon. I know he was going to do another motorcycle track day pretty soon.
Is that a bonding point for the two of you?
Well, no, we've never actually gone together, which is the shame of it. He did a track day a couple of weeks before I did, and I just did it, 2 weeks ago or so.
Yeah.
So we both sort of like our motorcycles, and I guess we both like speed and adrenaline-charged sort of things, so...
Do you travel around by motorcycle? You could do one of those Ewan McGregor long way round joints.
Yeah, I did do 5,000 miles through Europe with my dad back in 2010.
Oh, wow.
And so we took about 6 weeks and went on the road. That was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Actually. So looking back, you and I think the only point that we share in common is that we're virtually the same age. I'm 364 days older than you. okay. Michael. So you evaded April 1st by a day. I'm an April Fool's birthday boy. So
I actually evaded it by half an hour. I think I was born 12:30, just after midnight. on the 2nd, my dad was telling my mom to hang on. I would have liked to have been an April Fool, actually.
I don't know if you would. I've lived it. I don't know.
I think it's great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's a lot of jokes.
Sure, but like, you know, that day, you know, you're at least, you know, it's a prankster day, and you can enjoy being the prankster.
That's true, yeah.
You just have to get the better, you know, get April the better Fools prank. On people, exactly.
But that's pressure. After 38 years, man, I keep
you've got a year.
People.
You've got a year to work on it. You know?
I'm curious, since we're roughly the same age, I'm curious, like, what the cultural touchstones were for you growing up. Were you watching the same TV and films that I was? Like, what were you?
Probably. I mean, because in Ireland at that point, down in the countryside, anyways, we only had the two channels. It was RT1 and RT2.
Right.
And we got a lot of American programs, so it would be like Knight Rider, Chips, The A Team. All of those sort of shows, Heart to Heart, Magnum PI.
So you were into the hour longs. Did you do the sitcoms? Were you doing like the Alfs and the Silver Spoons and different
Silver
Strokes?
Silver Spoons, all of those as well. Absolutely. Silver Spoons. What was the one? What was the one where he drove around Ricky Schroeder?
Yeah,
and
that's Silver Spoons.
That was Silver Spoons. Yeah. Yeah, so we got all of that. We didn't really get a lot of English programs. That was on sort of obviously the English channels, which you could get if you lived in Dublin.
Right.
or, you know, I used to see bits and pieces when I went up to visit my relatives in the north of Ireland. Mainly American programs.
What were the... Because I feel like for any, like, cinephile from my perspective or from your perspective, I know you're both a film lover and obviously a practitioner, but like there's a shift usually in a childhood when you like, you know, we're enjoying like the 80s schlock. I'm sure you and I were enjoying kind of like all those like action movies and stuff, but at a certain point, like I remember like watching the Godfather films on those double VHS sets, mm-hmm. and like then going hardcore into everything Coppola. Like, do you mm-hmm. remember kind of like a demarcation moment where you kind of like went from movie lover to kind of film lover?
It kind of happened at the same time, really. I mean, obviously, sort of, you know, was always watching films. But I think around the age of sort of 15 or 16, really kind of started to approach it with more of a sort of, I don't know what the I just started to see it differently because I got introduced to those films from the 70s and American films from the 70s really was... The main sort of launching pad for me to sort of getting into acting and sort of realizing that this is what I wanted to do. They kind of coincided in a weird way. I just started getting into these films. And then at the same time, a past pupil of the secondary school that I went to, the high school that I went to, came back and started doing these drama and comedy classes.
Right.
So they both kind of happened at the same time. My mom introduced me to a lot of those films. So... really, to be fair to her, she was the one that kind of introduced me to Coppola and Scorsese and then the earlier films, you know, Montgomery Clift and
sure.
And then some, you know, the Kazan films with the Brando. But it sort of happened around the same time. And then I was, you know, became very obsessive about it very quickly. So.
Yeah. I would think you've had a chance, obviously, through, like, the parties and the award circuit and all that thing to meet some of those early heroes too. I mean, have you talked to like a Coppola, a Scorsese, and are you able to suppress the 15-year-old version of yourself that would go insane?
Yeah, I don't think I really can suppress that 15-year-old most of the time. It's kind of it's put me in some embarrassing scenarios. But I did meet Scorsese, which was amazing. We actually had a conversation at the urinal, which was...
Wait, who started the conversation?
I think I did, yeah, I'm pretty sure I did.
This is those embarrassing stories you were just referring to 20 seconds ago?
Yeah, exactly. but I met him sort of previously at another event, so I was just like sort of, you know... I was just reminding him of that at the urinal. And it was pretty funny. It was one of those moments to remember.
That's tricky because he's shorter than you, so it looks like you're staring down at him,
yeah,
and that could be misconstrued.
He thought I was, you know, sneaking a peek.
Hence why you haven't been in a Scorsese film yet, apparently.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I actually just watched Casino on the flight over here.
Amazing.
Again, which I hadn't seen for a while.
I feel like it got a short shrift at the time because it
absolutely
it
did,
felt
yeah.
like, I on surface, to be a Goodfellas retread, but in years since, now it...
It's so good.
It's an amazing film.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's an excellent piece of filmmaking. And yeah, he was a massive hero for me, Mean Streets, you know, and then of course, you know, well, we all know his repertoire, but yeah, Mean Streets was a big influence on me around that time as well.
And then Coppola,
of course, you know, Conversation, Godfather, which arguably would be my favorite film, actually.
Godfather?
Yeah.
Yeah, you look at that 3-year period he had, where it was Godfather, Conversation, Godfather 2, and it's absurd to think about that he had two of those were nominated for Best Picture in the same year, literally. It's amazing.
Yeah, and also the fact, you know, that he was cultivating
Zoetrope and that whole cadre.
And, you know, I think was such an influence on Lucas and all the guys that were coming up through, and they really kind of did look at him as the sort of godfather of this new movement. So, yeah, absolutely, how, you know, amazingly influential he was. And I remember him saying, you know, back in, I think around the time of Apocalypse Now, you know, the future of filmmaking is some girl that picks up a camera in Iowa and she can make a film. And that's what we've got now.
You're absolutely right, yeah.
You know, I think, you know, the only thing that's stopping that girl getting the film out there is the distribution, you know. But in terms of making a movie, it's never really been easier to do than now.
You mentioned, looking up to people. I was reading an article with Tom Hardy, and you guys went to the same drama school, correct?
That's right.
And he talked about, actually, you at the time being the guy that he, frankly, and others were looking up to as, like, kind of, like, who had the stuff.
I'm very flattered to hear that. I remember Tom well. I believe that I was in the third year, and he was in the first year. You could see that he was just very hungry then. He was out of the school, I think, in his first year. And we ended up doing Band of Brothers together.
Sure.
That was my first TV show. And then Tom really accelerated fast from there.
It took me a while longer
to get off the ground, but he just sort of came out of the blocks.
Though one could argue, I mean, he's talked about this, you know, extensively. Obviously, he had his troubles, and the way he's brought himself back and turned his career back around where he's now killing it, I mean, is remarkable.
Absolutely,
it shows this fortitude of spirit.
His personal life, absolutely. I remember he came out of Band of Brothers, and he got that Star Trek Nemesis movie, you know, pretty much straight away.
Yeah.
It's pretty phenomenal.
Was it an eye-opener for you? I mean, I've heard you talk about this before, because, yeah, Band of Brothers, you know, it's going a little ways back, and I know you came out to L.A. and probably did a lot of auditioning. Was that a wake-up call at the time to realize, okay, it's not going to be, despite being in a Steven Spielberg-produced HBO prestige project, maybe I've got some more work to do?
There was a lot of buzz around the fact, you know, that we were in Band of Brothers. For the first, I think, you know, few months after we'd finished rapping, you know, it was pretty exciting, you know, to be able to say I'm in Band of Brothers. But then I think there was an onslaught of about 30 guys that were saying they were in Band of Brothers. And it was like, you know, the novelty kind of wore off. But it was an exceptional thing to be part of for me. I mean, I felt so, and I still do feel very privileged to be playing real life heroes, number one, to you know, especially the guy, you know, that I was playing. Obviously, we all feel special, you know, close and have a closer affinity to the characters that we play. But Pat Burton Christensen, you know, was a pretty extraordinary guy.
Yeah.
So to have the opportunity to play him, number one, and then just to work with that bunch of people and to see the production, you know, value of that and the sort of efficiency and the passion and basically, you know, the huge team in place working together to make this come to the forefront. It was incredible.
Did you did you go through a period of kind of like doing, you know, your rite of passage of the big Hollywood auditions at the time? And do you look back at
that? Yeah, I think that went on for about, you know, after Band of Brothers, I was 22 when I did that. I think, you know, I was then very sporadically working, like 6 months, I'd get a gig. Another 6 months later, I'd get a, you know, 2 days on a TV thing. And it kind of went like that for about 5 years. And I sort of, you know, I was working in and out behind the bar and various different jobs. And then at about 27, I remember I didn't have to do other jobs to make a living.
That's a turning point.
That was, yeah, absolutely. I was like, you know, I kept saying, I was like, you know, just to get, you know, be jobbing. I'm good enough to be working. I'm good enough to be working. I'm good enough to be working. Aren't I? Am I? you know, so, yeah, and then, you know, since 30, the last 7 years have been...
It's been amazing.
Been incredible.
It's also interesting because, you know, I've talked to a lot of actors who talk about, like, the reality of the situation is, you know, a lot of journalists ask people, why did you choose this role, et cetera. And frankly, for a lot of actors, there's not much choice. They're taking kind of what's available because they are jobbing actors and they're just trying to make a living. You're in, frankly, a very privileged situation the last couple of years where you're getting to work with insanely talented filmmakers and you do have choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think, I don't know, I wonder if there's like a pressure and like, oh my God, this is what I always dreamed of. But now it's all on me. Now I actually have to, not only do I have to deliver, but I have to make the right decisions.
No, you know, I kind of, again, I learned a lot doing Hunger, working with Steve. You know, this idea of like, you know, listen, you know, we're all going to die. And it's like, yeah, I work hard prepping something. And I really, when we're filming it, I hope that I leave everything on the floor at the end of the day.
Right.
And then, you know, I walk away. I mean, like, I remember... I waited, you know, long enough to be in this position. So when it happened, I was like, I'm ready. I'm ready for this, and I'm going to work hard. And I realize how lucky I am to be in this position because it wasn't there before. So I'm not going to abuse it and be lazy. So the worst thing for me is if I walk away from a day's work and I was like, you know, I made a mess of that because I didn't put in the work.
Right, not because of the wrong choice, but just
because that's going to happen. You know, it's impossible. Well, maybe it's not impossible, but for me to get, you know, to even any day to get it right, you're always striving to do the best. But I'm never going to reach what I wanted to get. But hopefully, you get closer or something that's acceptable. But also, it's really, I think, for me, very important not to get stifled by that idea of, oh my God, this has to be a success or this has to be a success.
Right.
You know, I want to stretch things, learn, take risks, do things that excite me and hopefully other people find them interesting stories. But I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to get stifled by the fear of something not working or, you know, have I made the right choice here? Once I make a choice, I go for it. And then it's like, there's no regrets. It's you know, move forward. Try and learn. Find like sometimes I'm a little bit like a mouse that keeps going back electrocuting himself. I don't really know. Do I learn that much patterns of behavior?
That does speak to obviously the choice to do a film like this because like on the Hollywood guidebook it wouldn't say, you know, do this small quirky black comedy, paper mache wearing mask wearing character at this time. Certainly this time in your career, and yet.
Yeah, but the Hollywood guy. I think you know. The one thing that I've learned about films is there are no rules.
Yeah.
And what was, you know, something that was unacceptable at one point is, you know, the norm now or, you know, a formula that did work before just doesn't work anymore. You know, you write your own rules, I think, and just got to stay true to what my gut tells me. And when I read this script, you know, for the first time, I was like... What is, you know, like I say, I was like, what is this? This is, you know, totally bizarre and just really refreshing. And like I say, had me laughing and then had me sort of, you know, reaching for the Kleenex. it's those sort of things that you want to get out of a story, I guess.
Did you feel a little helpless in that mask? Because the physicality is fascinating to watch, especially on stage. There's almost like a little kind of like a stiffness, you know, in a way to his performance. But then at other times off stage, Frank kind of needs the assistance of others to even like manage.
Yeah, I think, that's exactly what you say, a stiffness and then a sort of also... a confidence that reverts back into an introverted character that becomes extroverted, that goes back. You know, I was always trying to stretch with that and play with that elasticity of an extrovert and an introvert, and somebody that could be quite confident and sort of sure, and then in all of this in the body language, and then somebody who's very unsure, and like you said, almost like an invalid at times that needs to be sort of, you know, guided around,
right?
And a dependency, and then an independence. You know, there's lots of things that I was trying to sort of flip and play with, you know, with this idea of like a really extreme bipolar case, you know, in there. So like by the time he gets to South by Southwest, he's worked himself so high, and the euphoria is there just before the crash.
Absolutely,
the physicality was, it's always important for me when I'm sort of, you know, trying to get into a character, try and find how they move. If they're a farmer, they move a certain way. If you sit at an office desk all day, you move a certain way, hold yourself a certain way. But this time, I just had to amp it up and dial it in a little more, because the expression of state of mind or emotional state was coming from the neck down.
Right.
So
he's also got a very sweet, sad scream by the end.
Yeah, that was like something
I
just wanted.
Is that your actual scream?
Yeah, I just wanted to get something that was really primal and sounded like an animal almost, that sort of, some, you know, that, or, you know, I always remember sort of growing up down, we grew up in the countryside, and there was lots of rabbits around the area that I grew up in. There was also stoats, which are like weasels.
Right.
And I remember whenever a stoat would catch a rabbit, that was the sort of sound. It was a high-pitched sort of scream. And just reminded me of that. I thought, you know, for that moment for Frank, you know.
It's a shock to the system. It's kind of...
Yeah, just, it's like paralyzing. Yeah. It's like, you know.
Recent guest of the podcast here was Daniel Radcliffe, who has talked to me and with others at length about the Fassbender test. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I was, again, deeply flattered and sort of, yeah.
So you have integrity, apparently, in the eyes of others. That's a good thing.
That's great. I mean, that's great. Hopefully, you know, it'll last. Yeah, no, I was, like I said, very sort of humbled by that. Sweet.
Did you got a bit of attention, ironically, for withdrawing a little bit the last "quote unquote" award season?
Yeah.
I mean, was too much made of that? I mean, did you get turned off by the kind of like glad handing of a couple years back, or was it just sort of? I mean, no, you were also working. I think you were doing Macbeth at the time, right?
Like, yeah, I think, you know, everybody's always looking for a story or an angle, and that was one that obviously ran because of one thing I said in an article, in the GQ article. You know, basically, I have nothing against any of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, fair play to anybody who gets involved in it. And I totally understand all of it. It's just for me, working was more of an attractive prospect, having done both. And, you know, it was very, very important for me to get Slow West made. It was the first DMC production. I put a lot of time and energy into trying to get, you know, that company sort of up and running and working with writers, working with projects. And so as a priority, it was higher up for me. But nothing against any of the Academy or any of the members or any of that, you know.
Right.
It was just... I had to do a job down in New Zealand, and
right.
I know that, you know, going on that campaign, it requires a lot of energy and focus, and it's 4 or 5 months, so it's that's the amount of time that I could make prep and make a film. You know.
I got the chance to spend a good amount of time recently with Jack Rayner for all those crazy Transformers things, you know, these worldwide crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's great for him.
Exciting opportunity for him, obviously, and you obviously worked together on Macbeth, which looks, even just from the print materials, looks like it's going to be fantastic.
Scary. I haven't seen it yet. I'll get to see something, I think, when I get back to Europe.
So they decided to call it Macbeth and not something else? Fear of superstition, nothing?
I'm pretty sure they're going with the title.
Are you a superstitious type? Does it not apply to when you're making the movie? Because a lot of people, when they've obviously gone on stage, they've been quite superstitious about even referring to it.
Yeah, I wasn't before, but like little things would happen in the film, you know, during the filming. Certain things that, you know, made one think, oh, my God. So at a certain point, you know, I think it was changed to the Scottish film. Yeah, you know, that play is, for me, it's my favorite Shakespeare play. And it's, you know, you are evoking whatever it is, you know, darker spirits or the underworld or whatever, you know, you want to call it. And it's, you know, it's such a particular piece that deals with sort of, you know, grieving, death, and two people trying to find themselves again in a relationship, having lost a child. And
Marion Cotillard, right? That's extraordinary.
Yeah, and, you know, for me, and certainly Justin and Marion, you know, we talked about them, you know, the murder of Duncan, it being such a huge act and something that the both of them were so... You know, it was a pact between them that that it was almost the murder was, you know, they were trying to bring themselves back together through such a heinous deed.
Right.
And I've got, you know, for a brief moment it happens, but then everything unravels from there, as we know, you know, that's how the play goes. But just that the idea of two people trying to find themselves through a murder again to reconnect as a husband and wife.
Do you want to, do some stage work soon? I know it's been a while since you've done something on stage.
It sure has. I think 2006 was the last time I did something on the stage. I will do it, but
is it again just not, sort of like not, the opportunities are there right now, and you can't, it's hard to say no to.
There's just
the Ridley Scotts, etc. of the world.
You know, absolutely. You know, there's only so much I can do, and you know, like I said, the DMC stuff. I really want to push that forward. Assassin's Creed. You know, working on these things, trying to get them right. And really trying to bring something special for the audience. So, you know, at the moment I'm really kind of just up to my eyeballs and all of that. I will definitely go back and do something. I enjoy it. It was something that I've always felt very comfortable with me. I started off doing pantomime, pub theater, and amateur sort of, you know, dramatics. And then I, you know, put together, you know, Reservoir Dogs at 18, directed that. And then I went, you know... played Oedipus at the next sort of school and Mother Courage. So, you know, I was very comfortable. But then I went to drama school in London, and it was, again, a very theater-based education.
Right.
So we were doing all the classics, you know, Shakespeare, Seneca. And we didn't get much time in front of a camera. And film was my original drawing to becoming an actor. It was like all those films we were talking about earlier, the 70s, you know.
Right.
Coppola, Scorsese, Lumet. So... that was the origin for me. So then when I, you know, when I left drama school in London, I said, look, I really, you know, I need to learn now. I need to get in front of a camera and start to develop a relationship with a camera and understand that. And that was really my focus. And kind of, I guess it didn't really sway too much for the last 15 years.
Right.
But I will definitely go back. But I just don't know when. It's got to be the right thing. And yeah, again, it's got to be the right person to direct.
Is there a, are you still as much a film consumer now? I mean, do you still watch a lot? And
not as much, no.
Yeah.
Not as much. I kind of, you know, find, again, my time is there's less of it. So when I do have some time off, I try and do things like get to a track.
And live your life as opposed to?
Well, yeah, just kind of, you know, get involved in stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, the danger perhaps for an actor that's like working like I am is that I start to lose touch with actually living. And that's where I'm, you know, supposed to be drawing experience from. So if I'm drawing, you know, if I'm doing make-believe all the time, then that's all I'm drawing from is make-believe. So I try and inject, into just doing, the act of doing things.
I don't want to say you're losing touch, but the fact that you're just wearing wall-to-wall leather and fur right now, it's a little disconcerting.
Yeah, I know, but it makes me comfortable. That's the main thing.
And I was lying, just for the record.
Not really, but he is. But he's not. Am I?
You'll never know. Prometheus, are you anxious to reteam with? This will be your third collaboration with Ridley.
Yeah, I just had dinner with him there last week. and just love Ridley. He's just such, it's incredible watching him on set and watching him sort of work, especially with such an operatic type of thing like Prometheus and such, yeah. And such a big scale, such a large crew, and just to see how his dialogue with each different department, it's just incredible.
It's like a James Cameron in that way, though. Really, they always say about James that he like can do every job on a set as well or better than anybody else.
Yeah, you know, it's just like I was talking to, you know, one of the stunt guys, Rob Inch, who sort of worked on a good few things with Ridley now, and he was just saying, you know, he was talking through an action sequence, and Ridley was like, "Yeah, yeah," just sort of doodling away, and he sort of, you know, finished explaining the action sequence, and Ridley just sort of lifted up a piece of paper, and he was like, "So that's what you're talking about?" And he'd basically storyboard the whole thing. You know, he's incredible.
I hope they give obviously Prometheus did well, but like I feel like the fanboys came out and it became a divisive film, and it's a gorgeous looking film. It's an amazing film, and
you know, it has audiences divided, yeah. Which, you know, is more interesting than people walking away that are indifferent.
Tis
you
true.
Know, at least at least tis true.
Tis true.
Tis true.
Tis true.
You know, at least there's conversations. Then, you know, people can argue at a dinner table, or you know, after they come out of the movie theater, they're talking about it later. That's always good.
Absolutely. I don't know why I lapsed into a little. Maybe it was the Macbeth
Shakespeare
talk.
Exactly. It's the bard, isn't it? Yeah.
It's always good to catch up with you, Michael. Congratulations. Honestly, Frank, I totally dug it. It's, as you say, funny, but also poignant in the end, and fine work and screaming and singing throughout.
Thanks, brother. Thank you.
It's good to see you, man.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, man. Buddy.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.